Thank you. I'd now like to invite Dr. Mark Ratain from the University of Chicago to discuss these abstracts.
Well, thank you. I was told I needed to update this if there's anything relevant. So since I've just co-founded a company called Prescript IQ, it's relevant, and if you want to invest in it, talk to me after the presentation. I appreciate the confidence of the program committee that I would have something useful to say here. I'm a medical oncologist, not a pediatric oncologist. I'm not an expert in germ cell cancer. I'm not an expert in nasopharyngeal cancer. I know literally nothing about hepatoblastoma. I do know something about cisplatin. I do know something about clinical trial design. And I do know something about the FDA and its views on drug development. So the topic today that I've been asked to discuss, balancing benefit and risk, has actually been of interest to the United States Congress. And 4 years ago, approximately, Senators Harkin and Enzi introduced this bill known as FDASIA, the Food and Drug Administration Safety and Innovation Act. It was introduced in the Senate May 15, 2012, and believe it or not, it actually was rapidly passed and enacted into law and signed by President Obama July 9, 2012. And notably, Section 905 of this bill is entitled Risk-Benefit Framework. And it basically requires the Secretary of Health and Human Services, to implement a structured risk-benefit assessment framework in the new drug approval process to facilitate the balanced consideration of benefits and risks, a consistent and systematic approach to the discussion and regulatory decision-making, and the communication of the benefits and risks of new drugs. So we're talking about an important topic in general, benefits and risks of drugs, and the FDA responded to this law by creating guidance. And you can find this on the FDA website, Structured Approach to Benefit Risk Assessment and Drug Regulatory Decision Making. And the theme I'm going to try to convince you of today is that this framework is important whether we're talking about an investigational drug in which a company is seeking regulatory approval, or we're trying to make decisions about drugs that we've used for a long time and we want to change dose or schedule. We should be using the same framework. So obviously with FDA guidance, the pharmaceutical industry, of course, would also have a high interest in this topic. And this was just published in Pharmacoepidemiology and Drug Safety, Recommendations for Benefit Risk Assessment Methodologies and Visual Representations. And really the concept here is this is at the end of the day, this is a subjective decision, how to weigh risks and benefits. And there are many different ways to present this information. Those of you who practice medicine do this every day when you sit down with a patient. In theory, at least, you should be talking about risks and benefits. And it's often hard to communicate this. And I think as we're talking about cisplatin and cisplatin toxicity and the potential benefit of cure versus the risks of lifelong complications, it's an important topic. So how do we frame this? Well, here's an example from this paper. And one way is a tree diagram. And the drug being exemplified here is eculizumab, a drug for psoriasis. And it shows favorable effects, unfavorable effects. And the details of the favorable effects are not important here. Unfavorable effects are things that we can understand serious infections and CNS complications of this monoclonal antibody, PML. Here are the data from the randomized trial, and one can see placebo versus eculizumab. One can see clear differences, and these are all clinically significant and I believe statistically significant differences that were reported. But what do you do with this information? So there's the investigational drug both increases efficacy and increases toxicity. And that's certainly a theme we see as oncologists, pediatric and medical oncologists, that we know that the more we give, the more likely we're going to have toxicity. We believe that more is better from an efficacy standpoint. The truth of that is the subject of a different talk. And here's another way that has been suggested to display these information. And this is, I think, the most important challenge to this group, is to really think about utilities and how you weigh the relative value of benefits and risks. And so these are utility-weighted benefits and risks, and there are a variety of ways to estimate utilities. Furthermore, one should allow for the possibility that individual physicians and patients will have their own utilities, and it's been suggested that one can create opportunities to do that through algorithms, websites, et cetera, so that one can actually calculate for an individual patient whether they think it's worth taking a drug given their utilities of benefit and risk. And you can see using these particular numbers, it came out as being favorable, and in fact, this drug was approved despite initial concern regarding the toxicity. So what is required to do benefit-risk analysis? I think the most important point is you need a control group. And I think ideally this should be a prospective placebo-controlled randomized trial. And we just heard of three studies, one of which was a prospective placebo-controlled randomized trial. One needs consideration of relative utilities of benefits and risks. What is the relative value of cure versus harm? Particularly lifelong ototoxicity is one example, or other complications, secondary malignancies, as we heard earlier in the session. Finally, one needs consideration of uncertainty of estimates. So in Dr. Brock's study, the prospective trial, we're faced with the fact that no matter what, we're going to have uncertainty because it's a relatively small trial. How do you factor in an uncertainty? How do you communicate that uncertainty to patients? So these are the three studies that we heard. The first one, a germ cell study with historical controls. There was data presented verbally regarding risk and control group. It was not explicitly shown. We have a study in nasopharyngeal cancer. Essentially historical controls, pre and post an amendment. And then we saw the third study in hepatoblastoma. We don't know any data regarding the benefit of the sodium thiosulfate on ototoxicity, although it's powered to detect a very significant reduction in ototoxicity from 60% to 35%. So let's look at the first study, the germ cell study. 210 patients, a relatively large study. Should this study be convincing because of its size? The primary objective was to determine whether a four-year estimated event-free survival, at least 92%, could be maintained with a reduction to three cycles. And we were given a complicated statistical justification for why this was the right threshold, and we were given complicated methodology on how all this was going to be adjusted. And we were told that the four-year event-free survival was 89%, and this was less than the expected compared to the hypothetical parametric model. So we have lots of uncertainty about these results. Well, let's go back a little bit in time, and we're going back now to the beginning of JCO, actually. We're going back to 1984 when there used to be a cooperative group called the Southeastern Cancer Group, led by Larry Einhorn, and their interest was germ cell studies, or a primary interest, and they conducted a randomized clinical trial with 184 patients. So why would COG not do a similar study? And this study was published. There's two JCO papers on it, an early publication by Dr. Einhorn, and then a subsequent publication by Scott Saxman with long-term follow-up. And I think it's quite clear that there's no difference in disease-free survival. You don't need a statistician to interpret this p-value for you. You don't need a hypothetical parametric model. You don't even need a statistician to design the trial for you. And unfortunately, I think a lot of these single-arm trials are just creating work for biostatisticians as opposed to information for prescribers and patients. So I think I challenge the COG investigators to justify their design, given the historical precedent that one can answer a question with 184 randomized patients. Now, the second study, we have historical controls, and again, pre- and post-amendment. It's really hard for me to interpret these results. We were told that there were 47 patients pre-amendment. We were told there were 51 patients post-amendment. It was unclear how the 9 patients that did not receive the 3 doses were analyzed, whether they were included in the pre-amendment and versus post-amendment analysis. But regardless, this is not a randomized trial. This does not allow us to do anything more than say we need to do another study. And I think that, again, if this is an important question deserves a randomized trial. If it's an unimportant question, it shouldn't be done in the first place. So finally, we have the hepatoblastoma study. And I do want to congratulate the Dr. Brock and colleagues on designing a randomized prospective trial in a rare disease subset. And this is done in many therapeutic areas. Oncology seems to be unique in believing that one cannot do randomized clinical trials in rare populations. And so this is the kind of trial we should be doing. The only caveat would be it would be nice if this were placebo-controlled, given that the endpoint, ototoxicity, could be considered subjective, but my understanding is there are objective ways to measure this, which mitigates that concern. The challenge here will be what to do with positive results. And we see that there is clearly, at least on the data that's been presented, no difference in event-free survival. Of course, there's uncertainty. This is a small study. This is not designed to be a non-inferiority study. It's too small for that. And so we'll have uncertainty at the end of the day and how regulators will handle that uncertainty. And let's assume that there's an opportunity to get accelerated approval based on these data, how a confirmatory study will be done, and again, with the assumption that the sodium thiosulfate reduces ototoxicity. So in summary, structured benefit risk assessment of new drugs is now required by FDA. The same principles should apply to studies of dose and or schedule outside the purview of FDA. And randomized trials are critical to provide reliable estimates of benefit and risk. Thank you for listening.